It just might be time for a mind shift. If you don't know what that means, join me, your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, here on this exclusive patrons-only episode, only available on Patreon. Hey everyone, welcome to this special patrons-only edition of Mindshift Podcast, available only on Patreon. This was actually something that I wrote in a Medium article many, many years ago about the evangelical purity culture, but I wanted to revamp it because of the recent documentary, Shiny Happy People, and the light that's being shined on the Duggars, the Bill Gothard IBLP cult. So let's take a look at this issue of Shiny Happy People and how exactly does the evangelical purity culture play into their story. What exactly is the motivation and the theology behind the evangelical so-called purity culture? Does it work in reality, or does it result in psychological and sexual harm being done to those who follow its tenets? How has it contributed to creating a culture of sexual abuse in the church? And finally, considering the new Amazon Prime series on the Duggar family called Shiny Happy People, Duggar Family Secrets, thankfully, some attention is being paid to the role that Bill Gothard's IBLP, that's the Institute in Basic Life Principles, formerly IBYC, Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts, which is what it was when I grew up in it, I think it's a cult. And what role did that play in all their dysfunction as a family? That the Duggars served as the poster family for Gothard's cult only helped to platform and mainstream his toxic teachings, which I can attest can do huge damage both to marriages and families. As I mentioned, I was raised in a family where my parents subscribed to Gothard's teachings, and it did incalculable damage both to my parents' marriage as well as to me and my siblings. Let's look at this issue of the purity culture. We'll start by taking a look at the general idea of the evangelical purity culture. How can it be defined? According to Joe Carter in an article on the Gospel Coalition site, he provides a helpful definition of the so-called evangelical purity culture as follows. He states that, quote, purity culture is the term often used for the evangelical movement that attempts to promote a biblical view of purity, 1 Thessalonians 4:3-8, by discouraging dating and promoting virginity before marriage, often through the use of tools such as purity pledges, symbols such as purity rings, and events such as purity balls, end quote. As a side note, by the way, it's hugely ironic, I think, that this helpful definition is courtesy of John Piper's Gospel Coalition. If you know anything about John Piper, he is a staunch defender of Christian or biblical patriarchy. He's platformed guys like Doug Wilson, who, of course, is another patriarchalist, on the Gospel Coalition's website. I'll touch more later on the connections between patriarchy, sexual abuses in the church, and the purity culture later on. The purity culture certainly seems to be an evangelical phenomenon, particularly in the United States, not so much here in the UK where I live. Christian celebrities, for example, such as Justin Bieber and Haley Baldwin, announced that they would wait until marriage to have sex. Former Seattle Seahawks American football quarterback Russell Wilson and his then-fiancée Ciara spoke often in public about their abstinence prior to marriage, as did model Ashley Graham and her then-fiancée Justin Irvin. In a way, then, these celebrities seem to make the idea of waiting for sex until marriage something that was cool, it was hip, rather than something that was scoffed at. I can remember as a kid in high school, the last thing you wanted to admit to your peer group was that you were still a virgin, but in the last few years, suddenly it's not so bad. Hey, if a celebrity can celebrate it, a Christian celebrity at that, maybe I shouldn't be ashamed of being a virgin. Within evangelicalism, sexual abstinence teaching has been popularized by such movements as the Silver Ring Thing, which over the last few years received over $1 million in funding from the U.S. federal government. This evangelical organization puts on shows at public schools, encouraging young people to put on the ring and thereby publicly pledge themselves to sexual abstinence until marriage. Denny Patton, who founded the movement in 1996, once stated in a CBS interview that, quote, "Our goal actually is to create a culture shift in America. We want to see the concept of abstinence be the norm rather than the exception," end quote. Patton claims that over 75% of attendees, become convinced to maintain their state of abstinence and put on the ring after participating in their show. The evangelical purity culture and accompanying modesty teachings has been heavily impacted by the teachings of such evangelical leaders as Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family. A second prominent figure has been, of course, Bill Gothard and his Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts, which, as I mentioned earlier, is now called Institute in Basic Life Principles, or IBLP. Television reality shows such as the Duggar family's 19 Kids and Counting and the other spinoff shows they had, they helped popularize Gothard's modesty teachings also, along with his IBLP organization, or we could say cult. The message behind the show was that if your family followed Gothard's allegedly biblical teachings, 7 basic principles for life and success, then you could be just as happy as the Duggars appeared to be. But as we'll see later, just as with the Duggar family, following Gothard's teachings can do incredible damage both to marriages and families alike. The problem with the Duggars was that they helped to mainstream and popularize Gothard's teachings as well as the IBLP organization, or as I've said, I think it's a cult. According to journalist Adrian Horton in a June 2023 Guardian piece about the Amazon Prime show, she writes, quote, "The Duggars, who regularly touted Gothard's seminars, were merely the," now quoting the co-director, "the front-facing image of this insidious organization," said the series co-director Olivia Crist, end quote. But it wasn't just the Duggars. In addition to shows like 19 Kids and Counting that promoted the benefits of the purity culture, there were also hugely influential books on the subject. One of the best examples was, of course, Josh Harris's 1997 bestseller, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, that he has since denounced, ironically, along with divorcing his wife of over 20 years. Together with evangelical organizations such as Lifeway's True Love Waits, which dates as far back as 1992, the evangelical purity culture movement has influenced countless tens of thousands of Christian children, young adults, and singles in evangelical or fundamentalist churches as they pledge to abstain from having sex before marriage. In churches promoting purity dogma, leaders encourage young people and singles to state their commitment to sexual purity by publicly vowing to refrain from any sexual activity until marriage. Interested individuals can participate in an online seminar offered by Lifeway Ministries entitled Authentic Love, Christ, Culture, and the Pursuit of Purity. According to their website advertising this two-part series, it, quote, "exposes culture's distorted messages about purity and love and reveals how God has created us for a lifestyle of personal holiness," end quote. Of course, it's hugely ironic. I argue that the deeply patriarchal system that the purity culture represents sends that distorted message about what constitutes truly healthy relationships and one's own self-esteem. Just as one example, we'll talk more about this later, women who are told that they must submit to their fathers and then later husbands end up having to suppress their authentic identity. And as we'll see later, purity dogma ends up creating a culture within churches and homeschooling families that is rife with sexual abuse, again, mainly against young girls and women. That, I believe, is another, quote, distorted message hidden within the purity culture. But, of course, somehow that never comes across. We can also plug in, at this point, 2 of Dr. Robert J. Lifton's markers of cults, the first of which is what he calls the demand for purity. High-control religious groups impose a standard on their adherents that is impossible for them to achieve, which in turn leads to the second marker, what he terms the cult of confession. Failure to achieve the impossibly high standards of purity laid on the followers leads inevitably to feelings of guilt and shame, followed by a public confession. These two markers of cults are what allow leaders to control group members. Lifton indicates that guilt and shame are two of the most powerful emotional levers that can be used to manipulate and control people once they buy into the theology of the group or the leader. But for those truly dedicated believers who really want to pledge their lives to living in purity, there's no shortage of resources. Companion Bible study books that go along with the Lifeway seminar involve the work Authentic Love by Dr. D.A. Horton for the guys and Authentic Love by Amy Jo Girardier for girls. The reality is that a very large part of the evangelical purity culture is its message that views the so-called secular world as highly suspect at best and downright evil or satanic at worst, since it allegedly promotes such sins as sexual promiscuity, pornography, illicit sex outside of marriage, homosexuality, and so on. Incidentally, this is yet another cult marker instilling an us versus them mentality, which leads to black and white Manichaean thinking in the followers. These alleged sins in this culture are all viewed as anathema to God's design for the family, one man, one woman bound together in a monogamous heterosexual marriage. In this world, there's no room for same-sex couples. Homosexuality is viewed as a sinful lifestyle choice, or in Doug Wilson's homophobic words, sodomy. And as I've already mentioned, within that marriage, citing verses like Ephesians 5, 22 and 23, they argue that it's by God's design that the woman should submit to her husband as unto the Lord. In this patriarchal system, he's the head of the family, the marriage, and the household, and it's her role to submit joyfully to his servant leadership. Another word for it would be complementarian. Different roles, it's argued, with each person complementing each other as a team. But at the end of the day, it's the wife who must take the subordinate role under her husband's authority, or what's called headship. I'll talk a bit more about this later, about how Bill Gothard framed it, what he called the so-called umbrella of authority or umbrella of protection model. From the evangelical point of view, therefore, given the fact that the secular humanistic culture promotes such a distorted message around sexuality, pushing sexual purity and abstinence on young people and singles should be a good thing. Surely adopting God's view of purity and sexuality must be the best way to live one's life. It certainly couldn't do any harm, right? Well, let's take a look at the damage caused by the purity culture. Unfortunately, there's a tremendous dark side to the whole evangelical purity culture. Shiny Happy People demonstrates that as happy as the Duggar family seemed in front of the camera, behind the scenes, there were scandals, sexual abuse, and cover-ups of that sexual abuse by Josh Duggar. They weren't as joyful as they appear to be on the screen. On the most basic level, purity culture can affect young people's mental health by putting them under tremendous pressure to conform to unrealistic expectations and standards. This can lead to such mental health issues as anxiety, depression, PTSD, religious scrupulosity, and religious trauma syndrome, just to name a few. And at this point, it's worth inserting the notion that a great deal of the purity culture conforms to what Dr. Stephen Hassan calls the BITE model of cults. The acronym stands for Behavior, Information, Thought, and Emotional Control. In every aspect of their lives, these young people and singles are controlled within the purity culture system. And beyond controlling behavior and information, within this system, even a so-called lustful thought can be a sin. And normal emotions, such as healthy sexual desire, must be unnaturally suppressed by the person attempting to live his or her life according to the purity culture teachings. To take another example of the harm the purity culture can do to a person, how might the teaching that marriage is only for a man and a woman affect a closeted gay teen in the church? At best, to fit in, they must suppress any elements of same-sex attraction, since, of course, they're told it's a sinful and evil lifestyle choice. God absolutely did not make you gay. There are only two genders, they're told, both of which are assigned by God at birth and are basically immutable. There's no room for a trans person in this worldview either. At worst, some who confess to the sin of same-sex attraction are made to participate in conversion therapy in an attempt to fix the flaws to their sexual orientation. There have even been examples of gay teens growing up in churches who, in their despair, ended up committing suicide out of sheer hopelessness that God would ever accept them or change them or that they would go to heaven. This is also, by the way, widespread in Mormonism, also due to its teachings on homosexuality. In their theology, a gay person cannot enter heaven. Moreover, multiple studies have demonstrated that the purity culture contributes to later marital problems, both relationally and sexually. That couple who did wait to have sex on their wedding night are often ill-prepared and ultimately disappointed that it wasn't the mind-blowing sex that they were promised. As I mentioned earlier, women can struggle with the notion that they are to submit to their husbands when oftentimes that's not their personality. They have to suppress their authentic selves to achieve that godly submission to their husbands. Men, who aren't really the strong leadership type, can also struggle with being the so-called spiritual head of the household. Regardless of personality and identities, I should say authentic identities, nonetheless, each person must suppress all that and at the same time desperately try to fulfill their supposedly God-ordained roles, these complementarian roles, which in my example is the case of my parents. That led to a very unhappy marriage, a deeply unhappy marriage, because the prescribed system simply did not work for them. But despite all that, they still tried desperately to make it work, which inevitably led to both of them being deeply unhappy and unfulfilled, trapped in a loveless sham of a relationship. One final observation is that the purity culture has fostered a culture that promotes sexual abuse in many churches also. The recent hashtag MeToo campaign of those who are speaking out about their sexual abuse stories gave rise to another related campaign, hashtag Church2 and hashtag Silence is Not Spiritual. We've seen time and time again that churches with a patriarchal leadership structure, only men in charge of all the important stuff, often creates a culture rife for sexual abuses, and I'll talk a little bit more about this later. The victim is typically blamed for leading him astray by dressing inappropriately or, in the words of Bill Gothard, being an eye trap. The man of God, on the other hand, shouldn't be accused of sin. Oftentimes, he's protected by the institution. Knowing all this to be the case, he's then free to continue abusing other victims. According to the twisted teachings of purity culture doctrine, on the one hand, young boys and men are taught that they have a raging, uncontrollable libido. It's described as an incredibly powerful sexual drive that cannot be controlled. For men, therefore, the only solution is to suppress their quite normal and healthy sexual drive and beg God for help to keep the raging beast under control. Boys are taught that men are visually stimulated, so if you look at too much at pornography, this can lead to addiction and ultimately, as well as inevitably, acting out on their desires in inappropriate ways, things like having sex outside of marriage, masturbation, and so-called porn addiction, or any other form of what is considered an unhealthy sexual exploration, which of course includes same-sex attraction, so homosexuality, lesbianism, these are major no-nos as well. Of course, these are all, within the purity culture, viewed as completely sinful, they're evil in the eyes of God. Now, from my own personal experience, I can attest that when I got involved in some of that as a young man, the shame I felt was absolutely incredible. And yet, despite begging God for years to take these alleged addictions away from me without any help coming from Him, I felt incredibly vile and helpless, trapped as any drug addict would. This led to such things as religious trauma syndrome, anxiety about going to hell, missing the rapture, and religious scrupulosity in my life. On the other hand, the modesty culture inculcates the belief that women are potentially little more than foul seductresses. They're cast as wicked temptresses who have the capacity, simply by dressing inappropriately or provocatively, to lead men astray sexually. Heaven forbid that she should show too much cleavage, bare shoulder, or thigh because she might end up getting raped by an out-of-control man. Keep in mind that historically the church has long taught that it was Eve who led Adam, the man, astray in the Garden of Eden. She was tempted because of her gullibility. He went along with it knowingly. So, of course, the blame lies more on her side than his. In the church's view, women simply cannot be trusted. And it's in this connection that many patriarchalists argue that this is why women shouldn't be allowed to be leaders in the church. They shouldn't allow to preach or teach men, as Paul argues in the book of 1 Timothy. Therefore, in the purity culture, the onus is placed on the women to cover up their body parts and dress modestly. In many cases, unfortunately, if she does end up being sexually assaulted by a man, more often than not, she's told that it was her fault for leading her abuser astray into lust and sin. More and more women, though, are coming forward with their horrific and heartrending stories of how they were sexually abused, raped, molested, and assaulted by people in churches, clergy, leaders, or church members alike. Sadly, so many of these victims were marginalized, silenced, blamed, and shamed by church leadership. These poor women experienced the classic Darvo tactic: deny, accuse, reverse victim and offender. The abuser is cast as the victim, since these unfounded allegations will likely destroy his career, family, and life. How could you accuse such a godly man? As an example of how this works, remember the story a few years ago, a disturbing example surfaced that demonstrates this, everything I'm talking about here, related to one Andy Savage, who at the time was a teaching pastor out of High Point Church in Memphis, Tennessee. 20 years previously, as a youth pastor in Texas, Savage had sexually assaulted a 17-year-old teen in his youth group. At the time, church leadership hushed up the incident and discouraged the victim, this young woman, from bringing forward her allegations about the assault publicly. Church leaders allowed Savage simply to resign without telling the full truth about what had happened in front of the congregation. Following his resignation, Savage moved to another state and became a successful minister for decades, that is, at least, until the story broke a few decades later. But even when the whole sordid thing came to light, the church of which he was a minister initially displayed nothing but sympathy for his plight. He even earned a standing ovation from the congregation after his so-called confession before the church, which conveniently omitted a lot of details about what had actually taken place. The shameful incident, and so many others like it, has once again pulled back the curtain on many churches' treatment of such offenders. We could point to, as a second example, the over 700 cases of documented clergy abuse that have come to light within the Southern Baptist Convention. And case after case is an all-too-predictable pattern. The female victim is silenced, shunned, blamed, and shamed. Those in leadership oftentimes cover up the story and possibly even ostracize or cut off the victim or her family if they dare to speak out about the abuse. In such an environment of shame and silence, the offender suffers little to no consequences and, unfortunately, is oftentimes free to continue abusing other victims. As a third example, in the case of the Roman Catholic Church, as we know, there have been countless examples worldwide of priests who sexually have abused children. But when allegations begin to surface, the church's response has been to tell no one, cover it all up, and then quietly relocate the priest to another parish. And then in the new parish, which is completely unaware of his history of sexual abuses, the priest then continues to abuse more unsuspecting victims. Unfortunately, as we've seen, this has sadly happened more times than can be counted, and the victims number in perhaps the tens of thousands, maybe more, it's hard to say. And of course, I'd be amiss if I didn't mention the ultimate example, and we're talking about shiny, happy people here, Bill Gothard himself. He was credibly accused of sexually harassing and perhaps molesting maybe, what, over a dozen young women over years when he was the head of IBLP. Okay, he was forced to quit, he was forced to resign, but he has never, to this day, faced any meaningful consequences for his actions. Let's take a closer look at some of the theology, some of the doctrine behind the evangelical purity culture. In many churches that teach purity culture doctrine, one common feature involves a continuing culture of patriarchy, both in the home and the church. Specifically, women's purity and virginity are treated as a commodity, both by the church and by the parents of their female child. Within these deeply patriarchal structures, oftentimes it would appear that fathers are seeking to maintain control over their daughters with the aim of successfully delivering a virgin to the altar on her wedding day. Of course, she is to submit to his authority right up to the day of her wedding, at which point she'll transfer that submission to her husband. In the IBLP Bill Gothard patriarchal purity culture theology, for example, there's special attention paid to a father's position of godly authority over the family, the infamous umbrella of protection model I talked about earlier. As the head of the household and the marriage, everything ultimately rises and falls upon the father to do everything in his power to guarantee and shepherd his son or daughter's sexual purity until their wedding night. As pointed out above, in the biblical view, it was Eve who, in her foolishness, was led astray by the serpent. Paul indicates that Adam was not led astray, but rather followed the lead of Eve, and that act plunged all subsequent humanity into sin. This is the root of the original sin doctrine. On this basis, women are therefore viewed as the weaker sex. As mentioned, Gothard taught that they should submit to their fathers and ultimately their husbands, so there is special care needed by the father to safeguard his daughter's virginity while she's still under his oversight and protection. Once she's handed over to her husband, it will then be his responsibility to lead his wife and family in the ways of God. Her only option is, of course, to submit to him. Influencers such as Dr. Vodi Bakum go so far as to promote the so-called stay-at-home daughters model, which literally keeps young women at home and under their father's control until they are married. We've even heard accounts of women in this system who don't have a driver's license, they don't go to college, they don't go to university, they don't go to training, they don't have any marketable skills outside the home. And of course, why should she? She doesn't need any of those things because she'll end up a stay-at-home mom. She'll be that perfect, submissive homemaker while her breadwinner husband is out conquering the world and taking dominion. And as with all things Bill Gothard, there's always consequences to the so-called positives he promoted, these so-called principles that he said everyone should live by. What if a person doesn't submit to their God-ordained authority, rebelling and slipping into sexual sin before they're married? On the one hand, when viewed negatively in the Gothard construct, if the son or daughter fails to maintain their virginity and sexual purity outside of marriage, the judgment of God will land not just on them, but on the father also as a responsible party. Being involved in sexual sin removes that son or daughter out from under the father's so-called umbrella of authority and opens them up to the attacks of Satan and his demons. This type of purity culture mentality in turn can lead to an all-pervading sense of guilt, trauma, and shame about anything that might damage that commodity or loss of potential blessing for all parties involved in the transaction. Therefore, if that son or daughter loses his or her virginity, the blessing is potentially put in jeopardy, and God is surely angry with all parties involved for failing to live up to his righteous standards. That perfect gift of the son or daughter's virginity has now been spoiled, and it's one of those things that can never be repaired or replaced. This explains why so many parents within this system buy into the so-called courtship model for their children of dating age. Serving as godly parental chaperones for all the kids' outings will help guarantee, of course, that their children won't fall into sexual sin before their wedding night. On the other hand, when viewed positively, the entire construct becomes a potential twofold blessing for the parties involved if all the purity guidelines are followed carefully. The parents believe God will bless them for their hard work in preserving their son or daughter's virginity. God will especially bless the obedient, newly married, sexually pure couple who worked so hard to maintain their virginity until their wedding night. That mind-blowing sex will be theirs and more if they can just hold their raging desires in check long enough to make it to the wedding bed. Of course, the purity culture does not merely conclude on the wedding night. Once the handoff of that virginal couple occurs on the altar, so the purity culture thinking goes, the newlyweds will enjoy not just an incredible sex life, but a marriage and family that are blessed and honored by God, since they both preserve their purity until the appropriate time. Essentially, both parties view the entire construct as a transaction. It's seen as a win-win for all involved. As a third party involved in the transaction, the church also partakes in the blessing for having done its part to promote the truth from the Bible about the priority of purity in the lives of its congregants. Many churches host purity balls and promote events like the ring thing and more. But why should the church as an institution be so concerned with delivering virginal couples to the altar? Well, it stands to reason, given the theological underpinnings of the entire movement, that some of that godly blessing delivered both to the parents and to the happily married virginal couple would overflow on the church also for having done its part too. Let's look at some of the purity culture doctrine. Where do the notions of purity and modesty originate? The theology behind such a desire is rooted in two core purity culture teachings. First, that personal holiness and purity are incredibly important to God. Sinfulness in general, in this way of thinking, results in alienation from God, backsliding into sin, and in some traditions, possibly even the loss of one's salvation. This explains the core of Bill Gothard's theology. He argued that if a person structured their life around seven key godly principles, they would experience success and blessing on multiple levels. A key element to this pursuit of godly holiness involves abstaining from fleshly desires, which of course includes sexual activities. Often this is presented to young people who are battling their sexual urges and struggling to maintain their purity and personal holiness as an ongoing battle against the influences of the pervading sexual culture. You know, the world is always seeking to drag you down into the pit of hell, isn't it? A second key aspect of the purity culture doctrine, as I noted earlier, is the belief that God reserves a special blessing for those two people who preserve their virginity until their wedding night. Church leaders explain to their congregants that this is God's vision both for the family and the institution of marriage itself. One common analogy used is that a person's virginity is likened to a Christmas or a birthday present. That special unopened gift is to be presented to their partner on the wedding night. If, however, the gift is opened prematurely, i.e. the person losing their virginity, it's forever spoiled. It can never be repackaged the way it was originally. It's damaged beyond repair. So clearly, maintaining virginity in this line of thinking is hugely important. Thus, in the purity culture, teens and singles are encouraged, mostly by a concerned parent in the church, it appears, to maintain their purity by engaging in the following activities: taking a vow of chastity, signing a virginity pledge, and wearing purity rings. The purity rings are a public symbol that the person has committed to a life of chastity and sexual abstinence until their wedding night. Some evangelical churches, I mentioned, hold father-daughter purity balls, or put on purity pledge services for their teens and singles so that they can make their vows, both to God and to their parents, in front of the entire congregation, all of whom act as witnesses to their covenant. The young person then enters into a covenant between God, their parents, and the entire church. Thus, the stakes for getting it right are incredibly high, as is the pressure to conform. Let's start wrapping it up by looking at an assessment of the toxic teachings of the evangelical purity culture. I just think it's hugely ironic that despite all the good-sounding intentions of this movement, multiple studies have demonstrated that the purity movement, in fact, leads to the very opposite sort of behavior it intends to promote. Just as one example, in a legalistic move to avoid vaginal sex and remain, quote, sexually pure, the culture contributes to many a Christian teen experimenting with things like oral and anal sex. In this way of thinking, teens and single adults believe they're sidestepping having real sex, vaginal sex, by engaging in all these activities. But the reality is that they're just as likely to contract an STD by not using condoms or by practicing unsafe sexual activity. But what if the unthinkable happens and that romantic vision is shattered? What if the young person or single adult who originally committed to a purity pledge does indeed make a mistake and falls into sexual sin? In this case, the purity culture teaches that it's their fault and the result of their own individual sin. Just like spoiling that Christmas or birthday present, losing one's virginity prior to marriage is viewed as something irretrievably lost. There's oftentimes a sense that the person has forever altered God's original will for their lives. I've personally seen this in the case of at least two of my siblings. Raised in the midst of the Gothard purity culture theology, once they lost their virginity, two of my sisters, they were absolutely devastated. They were convinced that they had destroyed God's original plan for their lives. From that point on, they figured the best they could hope for was plan B, C, D, etc. There was never any chance that they'd get back to plan A. That one was forever gone and lost to them. In the case of my sister Valerie, as a third example, and we did a whole podcast on this, she not only lost her virginity, she ended up pregnant at 17. I recall my mother explaining to me that the reason Valerie ended up pregnant was because, well, she had removed herself from her parental and, of course, godly umbrella of protection. Cruelly, they worked within an IBLP institution, ironically named Burden Bearers, and forced Valerie to give up her baby for adoption. After having her daughter, when she wanted to come back home, my parents hung up the phone on her, leaving her out in the cold. Now, so much for Christian love, huh? Let's talk about purity culture and sexual abuse in the churches, something I've talked about a little bit before here. Beyond the tradition of purity culture in terms of parenting and church culture, what connection is there between that culture and sexual assault and abuse of young women and boys within churches by clergy, those in leadership, or church members? I talked about this a bit ago, but it's worth looking at a little bit more in detail now. The purity culture is intimately connected to this type of situation, unfortunately. Many churches have an unwritten rule. Silence is golden. Unfortunately, many times abuse victims say nothing if they have been abused. There's an unbroken rule of silence in many churches. Women and girls, in particular, are often not believed when they come forward with allegations of sexual assault and abuse anyway. Why come forward when you won't be believed, or worse yet, blamed for what happened? No wonder so many reason that there's no point in even trying to tell their side of the story to someone in authority. The chances of them reporting it to the police are even less likely. All too often, men in positions of authority, typically clergy or church leaders, are rewarded with virtually unchecked power. This is the dark side of the patriarchal leadership structure. There's often a sense that the holy man serving God can do no wrong. One's wrong to question that authority as a layperson or even as a fellow leader within the church. That clergyman in authority is anointed by God, placed by God in that position, and alone has the ability to rightfully divide the word of God, both teaching and applying the Bible to the congregation. Who are they to question his God-ordained authority and leadership? But if that clergyman does do something to a girl or a woman in terms of sexual assault or abuse, the modesty culture teaches, as we saw already, that it's typically because she led him astray. Much of the time, she is blamed for it, and he, at worst, must only deal with his individual sin rather than face legal or professional consequences of committing a crime. Thus, as mentioned above, in the case of Pastor Andy Savage of High Point Church, in the church's view, his individual sin never crossed over into the commission of a crime, which it was. This goes a long way toward explaining why Savage received such sympathetic treatment, both currently and at his former church. He fell into sin, so we should feel sorry for the guy and blame the unfortunate victim for leading him astray. I recall once hearing Doug Wilson, I think it was on a YouTube video, talking in the context of clergy or church sexual abuse, that he'd be careful to differentiate between whether or not it was a sin or a crime committed by the offender. If it only fell into the category of a sin, then it's something that the church can handle in-house. No need to involve the authorities, no need to call the police. It can all be taken care of by church leadership instituting church discipline on the sinner. If it's a crime, though, then Wilson claimed that, of course, he'd report it immediately to the police, but that he would even think in those terms, parsing it out that way, reveals a lot about the mindset within this type of culture. It also shines a light on the handling of the Josh Duggar situation. When the first allegations that he'd been sexually molesting some of his sisters and their friends came out, rather than involving the authorities, his parents instead sent him away to an IBLP counseling facility in Little Rock, Arkansas. According to Doug Wilson's theology, we could place that model over the top of it, What Josh did, in their view, only rose to the level of a sin, not a crime, so it could all be handled in-house. That he clearly wasn't fixed was proved years later when in 2021, authorities found child pornography on his computer at the car dealership where he worked in Arkansas. Now convicted as a registered sex offender, he's facing a 12-plus year stretch in prison, and a lot of hard questions are being asked about how the whole thing was handled all those years ago. A lot of cover-ups, a lot of questions are being asked. All right, let's conclude this little episode. As we've seen, purity culture is a twisted theology that does incredible damage by teaching its adherents that on the one hand, women must be constantly aware of the fact that all men, regardless of age, are constantly lusting after them and only have one overriding desire, and that's to have sex with them. Simply on the face of it, such a view cannot possibly lead to healthy or constructive relationships between men and women if that's actually the way it is. In the purity culture, young girls and women are taught that they must always dress modestly, even covering up ankles and shoulders, because there's every possibility that they will cause a man to stumble and lead them astray into lust and sexual sin. Women who are the victims of sexual assault, as we've seen, are oftentimes blamed for their part in leading the man astray, or in Gothard's words, being an eye trap. Boys and men, on the other hand, are taught that their sexual drive and libido is like a raging but sleeping beast that, once awakened, cannot be tamed. Therefore, the best approach, they are told, is to suppress their sexual drive, which is a normal and natural sexual drive, by the way, and pray to God, beg God for help to overcome addictions to things like pornography or sexual activity outside of marriage. This type of thinking can be witnessed in the behavior of prominent evangelical leaders who adhere to the Billy Graham rule or the Modesty Manifesto. This rule of never being alone with any woman other than your wife is followed by such high-profile Christians as former Vice President Mike Pence, as well as many other evangelical leaders. Doing this follows the biblical injunction of avoiding the appearance of evil and never opens up the man to any sort of allegations of an affair or sexual assault. In this way of thinking, purity is maintained by the man never being alone with any other woman other than his wife. The rule is followed to avoid the appearance of evil and the temptation that he might slip into, apparently unavoidable, sexual sin if left alone with a woman who is not his wife for any length of time. Moreover, in this view, women are cast as fundamentally dangerous. They are foul temptresses who will, most likely, lead that man astray who can obviously not control his sexual urges. Ultimately, then, the purity or modesty culture can be incredibly damaging, both to girls and boys growing up in evangelical churches who promote such twisted theology. When they grow up to adulthood, they are often left with many broken pieces of their lives to pick up and fix. They must deal with such issues as religious trauma syndrome, shame and guilt, sexual dysfunction or their sexual orientation, anxiety, PTSD, recovery from sexual abuse, and more. Many have had to seek counseling or therapy to recover from the damage caused by purity and modesty culture teaching. And of course, there's what I mentioned earlier, this issue of men getting away, I should say men in high positions getting away with it. It is absolutely the ultimate irony, I think, the fact that Bill Gothard himself was credibly accused by, what, over a dozen women who he sexually abused for years, and he got away with the whole thing. Okay, he had to resign from the IBLP cult, but he's still out there. He has never, to this day, faced any repercussion for his actions in abusing so many women. The truth is that religion has had a long history of controlling its followers by manipulating their guilt and shame levers around the area of sexuality. The evangelical purity culture, it would seem, fits that description all too well. Thanks for coming along with me on this little journey looking at the legacy of the shiny, happy people thing, the Bill Gothard IBLP cult, and of course, the role that the evangelical purity culture plays in the whole thing, which, as we've seen, is quite a toxic and damaging theology. And I just wanted to mention one more thing. If you've been triggered by watching the documentary series Shiny Happy People, as I know some people in our closed Facebook group have commented, those of us who were raised with any aspect of Bill Gothard, IBLP, cult, the evangelical purity doctrine, it can be very triggering and bring up a lot of stuff from our past. Leave a message in this chat on this post and I'll respond to it. We'll have a conversation about any issues that you might be struggling with. So thanks for coming along with me as we took a look at Shiny Happy People, the toxic teaching of evangelical purity culture. I'll see you on the next Patrons Only episode here on Mindshift Podcast.